Penguin Random House Audio presents Cloud Hidden, Whereabouts Unknown, A Mountain Journal by Alan Watts. Read for you by John Lee. To Sandy Jacobs. Searching for the Hermit in vain. I asked the boy beneath the pines. He said the master's gone alone, herb picking, somewhere on the mount. Cloud hidden, whereabouts unknown. Jad Dao, 777 to 841. Translation, Lin Yutang. Preface. The poem above, by Jad Dao of the Tang Dynasty, suits my mood and provides the title of this book. I live between two places. A ferry boat on the Sausalito waterfront, and a lonely cottage in the foothills of Mount Tamalpais, just north of San Francisco. A mountain sacred to the Indians, which wraps itself in an atmosphere of strange beneficence. During the past 3 years, I have done almost all my writing in this cottage. This includes my recently published autobiography, In My Own Way, and a considerable number of short pieces written for my journal, published for subscribers, and for such magazines as Playboy and Earth. Most of the latter are assembled here in the form of a journal with dated entries, though they are ordered by content rather than chronology, because my thinking spirals. It does not go ahead in a straight line. Some critics will therefore call me repetitious, but I have found, in the process of teaching, that most students do not understand one's ideas unless they are repeated, under differing analogies or in varying forms of words, as a musician constructs variations on a theme. Besides, what I mean by understanding is not simply verbal comprehension. It is feeling it in your bones. The form of this book is therefore that of a mountain journal, concerned with the philosophy of nature, ecology, aesthetics, religion, and metaphysics, and the entries are grouped more or less according to those topics. The dates will allow those who are chronologically oriented to rearrange them in their mind's eye. Alan Watts, Druid Heights, California, Spring, 1972. The Water, April, 1970. Ever since I can remember anything at all, the light, the smell, the sound, and motion of the sea have been pure magic. Even the mere intimation of its presence, gulls flying a little way inland, the quality of light in the sky beyond hills which screen it from view, the lowing of foghorns in the night. If ever I have to get away from it all, and in the words of the Chinese poet, wash all the wrongs of life from my pores, there is simply nothing better than to climb out onto a rock and sit for hours with nothing in sight but sea and sky. Although the rhythm of the waves beats a kind of time, it is not clock or calendar time. It has no urgency. It happens to be timeless time. I know that I am listening to a rhythm which has been just the same for millions of years, and it takes me out of a world of relentlessly ticking clocks. Clocks, for some reason or other, always seem to be marching, and, as with armies, marching is never to anything but doom. But in the motion of waves, there is no marching rhythm. It harmonizes with our very breathing. It does not count our days. Its pulse is not in the stingy spirit of measuring, of marking out how much still remains. It is the breathing of eternity, like the god Brahma of Indian mythology, inhaling and exhaling, manifesting and dissolving the worlds forever. As a mere conception, this might sound appallingly monotonous, until you come to listen to the breaking and washing of waves. Thus, I have come to live right on the edge of the water. I have a studio, library, a place for writing on an old ferryboat tied up on the waterfront of Sausalito, north of San Francisco. I suppose this place is the nearest thing in America to a Mediterranean fishing village. Steep hills clustered with little houses, and below, along the rim of the bay, a forest of masts rocking almost imperceptibly against a background of water and wooded promontories. In some ways, this is a rather messy waterfront, not just piers and boats, but junkyards, industrial buildings, and all the inevitable literature of our culture. But somehow the land and seascape absorbs and pacifies the mess. Sheds and shacks thrown together out of old timbers and plywood, heaps of disused lumber, rusted machinery and rotting hulls. All of this is transformed in the beneficent presence of the sea. Perhaps it is the quality of the light, especially early in the morning and towards evening, when the distinction between sky and water becomes uncertain, when the whole of space becomes opalescent in a sort of pearly, luminous grey, and when the rising or setting moon is straw yellow. In this light, all the rambling mess of sheds and junkyards is magical, blessed with the patterns of masts and ropes and boats at anchor. It all puts me in mind of landfalls a long way off, and all the voyages one has dreamed of. I look out now across a wide space of nothing but water and birds, ending in a line of green slopes with clumps of trees. Right over the edge of the boat, the water contains, seemingly, just under the surface, a ceaselessly moving network of reflected sunlight, through which a school of very tiny fish passes delightfully uncaught. Yet only a few yards from where we are moored, tackle shops sell the salmon and crabs with which this particular area abounds. This is the paradox of the ocean. Sand, flying spray, pebbles and shells, driftwood, sparkling water, space incredibly luminous with cloud banks along horizons, underlying skies, into which one's imagination can reach without end. But under the surface of both sky and water, there is the grim business of preying. Men and birds against fish, fish against fish. The tortuous process of life continuing by the painful transformation of one form or body into another. To creatures who do not anticipate and reflect imaginatively on this holocaust of eating and being eaten, this is perhaps not so terrible. But poor man, skillful beyond all other animals, by being able to think in time and abstractly knowing the future, he dies before he is dead. He shrinks from the shark's teeth before they bite him, and he dreads the alien germ long, long before its banquet begins. At this moment, I see a gull that has picked a crab from a tide pool. Sprawled now upon the sand, the crab shrinks from the walls of its shell, which is resounding to the tap, tap, tap of the gull's beak. Who's that knocking at my door? I suppose the shell of a crab, a clam, or a mussel, is the boundary of its universe. To put ourselves into their position, we would have to imagine a knocking sound, louder and louder, a sound which doesn't come from anywhere in particular, from some door, the walls, the ceiling, the floor. No, instead, think of a knocking which comes from everywhere, beating against all the boundaries of space and consciousness, intruding like some utterly unknown dimension into our known and familiar world. Let me in, let me in. I love you so much I could eat you. I love you to the very core, especially the soft, juicy parts, the vitals most tender and alive. Surrender to this agony, and you will be transformed into me. Dying to yourself, you will become alive as me. We shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, on the morning when the last trumpet sounds. For behold, I am he who stands at the door and knocks. There is simply no way of getting around all this. The gull can't really be said to be rapacious or greedy. It's just that his being alive at all is the same thing as eating crabs. Seabirds are transformations of fish. Men are transformations of wheat, steers, and chickens. A love for the food is the very agony of the food. To object to this inseparability of pleasure and pain, life and death, is to object to existence. But, of course, we cannot help objecting when our time comes. Objecting to pain is pain. So far as we know, the gull and the fish don't philosophize. They appear instead to enjoy life when they are eating and hate it when being eaten. But they don't reflect upon the process as a whole and say, "How rough to have to work so hard for a living," or, "It's just hell having to watch out all the time for those damn gulls." I'm sure that in their world, this is all something that just goes along with life, like having eyes or feet or wings. But man, with his astonishing ability to stand aside from himself and think about himself, in short, to comment on life, man has done something which confuses his own existence down to its roots. For the more sensitive he is, the more he finds the very act of living in conflict with his moral conscience.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?